welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Thomas Vasiliadis, CEO of Vivacore, a company that's developing a medical device that can take over the complete function of a patient's heart. The company, which is headquartered in Houston but has the majority of its operations divided between California, Australia, and even parts of Europe, recently closed $18 million in funding to support its FDA clearance and pathway to clinical trials. Thomas joins the show today to explain the revolutionary technology and unique challenges he's facing leading the company toward human implantation and eventually commercialization. Hi, Thomas. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks. Great for having me part of this program. Sounds exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you because I've covered Vivacore for a while over the years, but I've never actually gotten to sit down and talk about it. So let's just start from the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your background in medical device technology and your career leading up to Vivacore.
Sure. So actually, I started as a heart surgeon. So practiced for almost 20 years. And during that time, I also worked with a variety of different companies, big companies, small companies, and became sort of on the side, very interested in the whole process of device development and commercialization. And at some point in my career, decided that it might be nice to transition to that, having put in quite a number of years of days in the OR, and now moving on to something new. And so started with one of the best and biggest medical device companies in the world, Medtronic, really where they taught me how to do things well and the systems and processes necessary for device development. Was there for a number of years, spent some time in a company called Abiomed, which is on the East Coast. Also got more involved with the commercial side of things as a general manager. And then a number of years ago, met Daniel Timms, because this is a small community and we go to a lot of the same professional societies, and really became very intrigued with the Vivacore technology. And he and I said to each other, boy, it'd be great to work together at some point. But years went by, and then I became available, and they were looking for someone to help them out. And so a year ago, January, I joined the company. And it's been since I've left heart surgery practice, it's been the most fun that I've ever had. It's been very exciting.
You come with a very great perspective then on the challenges for heart health and the transplant process is not, it's got its own challenges. And so you knew firsthand kind of the impact this technology is going to make. So tell us a little bit about the technology and why it's so revolutionary in its field.
Sure. The fundamental problem, or what we say in the business, the unmet clinical need, is the fact that we have literally thousands, tens of thousands of people every year in the U.S. alone that die of heart failure for all kinds of different reasons. And there really is only one good long-term solution, and even then it's not a perfect solution, and that's heart transplant, right? So if your heart is failing, you can either get an artificial pump, but those sometimes are limited by what they're able to do. And sometimes it's also a bridge to a heart transplant. Transplants are a great solution, but even then, they may only last 10 or 12 years. And so if you have people who are in their 20s and 30s, some of which had congenital heart disease that now have heart failure, and there isn't a good option for them because they could potentially get a heart transplant, but then what do you do in 10 years? You know, getting another transplant is not always straightforward. And so what is a good long-term solution for tens of thousands of patients every year who suffer from heart failure that the alternative is they die? And so the premise behind Vivacore is to create a totally artificial heart and take the heart out and replace it and build it in such a way that it can be the only solution and the final solution that a patient needs to live the rest of their life. And in order to do that, the design is critical. One has to design it so there aren't complications, what we say, the adverse events, right? So things that interact with the body are always favorable. You have an artificial surface interacting with blood and with biologic tissue. So the design is critical. And then it has to be durable. You have to create a system that moves blood that isn't going to wear out or develop some sort of mechanical wear. The BioCore system is based on magnetic levitation, which I think most people are at least familiar with when they hear about maglev trains. And so our pump is just one moving impeller that sits in the middle of the housing where the blood is. So imagine an artificial heart. It's a container that has your blood, and the device is spinning on the inside. It's basically a wheel that's spinning the blood to both the left and the right sides of your body in terms of the systemic circulation, your head, your organs, and then the pulmonary circulation to the lungs to get oxygen, right? The device, the Impella on the inside is suspended by magnets. So it's not touching anything. And so theoretically, the device has no wear whatsoever and could last as long as the patient could possibly live. And that's new to the field. We do have, there is a device that uses magnetic levitation that helps with only one part of the heart. But this is designed to completely replace the heart. So one is able to take out the diseased heart and just start anew and give the patient a completely self-sustaining device that will, you know, theoretically, and remains to be seen, but we've designed it to last as long as the patient could possibly live.
The premise is very exciting, I'm sure, to a lot of people who have family members and have seen the damage heart disease does on people and then the loss on their family too. So that's very exciting to see. Now, in terms of deployment, I know medical device development is a long game. So where is the company at now in terms of development and regulatory benchmarks?
Yeah, so Daniel Timms is the founder, and he has been at this since he was a postdoc in Australia. And these sorts of pumps and designs require iterative over and over again, trying and improving and improving and testing and improving. And this has been going on for decades, actually. And then he came to the U.S. and partnered with what is considered really the center of the universe when it comes to pumps. Blood pumps, and that's the Texas Heart Institute. And that's why we spend a lot of our time in Houston, because they have put in every single pump ever designed, some of which have made it to commercialization, some of which have not, some of which made it to commercialization and are no longer on the market because of problems. And so that's kind of where the development started. That's the history behind it. And it's taken multiple iterations and a lot of testing to get to the point where we are now, which is where we're satisfying all the requirements by the FDA that are necessary to get approval to do a human trial. So the process is known as an early feasibility study. It is not a study in which we would do a handful of patients and then it becomes approved on the market. It's a study to show that the device is safe and possibly effective. From there, if things go well with those few patients that we will do, then we will launch into what's known as a pivotal trial. So we are within weeks of submitting all the testing that we've been doing. And this is a huge amount of, it's a giant document of anything you can think of in terms of biocompatibility, compatibility with the blood, bench testing, animal testing, on and on and on. It's a huge document, and there are a lot of requirements that we have to show the FDA. They will take their time and review it and then tell us whether we can go ahead and start implanting in humans. And the first patients will be these patients who have no other option. that if we don't give them the device, they will not survive. And we start there. And then we study device, we learn. Perhaps we have to make modifications to the whole system, perhaps not, we'll see. And then based on the first dozen or half dozen patients, depending on how many we feel like we need to do, we'll then go into a more rigorous trial that actually looks at more data points than we are even now and enters more patients into the study. And then that's when, at the end of that, you would get market approval. So the device development process in the U.S. is a long one, although right now it's probably the best country to bring new technology. Several years ago, even in my career, we would typically look towards Europe to start because the regulatory requirements were less burdensome. But the FDA saw the fact that a lot of U.S.-based technology was going outside the country for their first in human studies and created a program that facilitated and incentivized companies to stay here. So we're taking advantage of that.
That seems like a good opportunity for BiVACOR. And I want to talk a little bit about where you're located and how you operate. But first, to build off of, you know, where you're at now, I know recently the company closed $18 million in funding to support this big document development and FDA approval. So tell me a little bit about how you're deploying that capital.
Yeah, so as you might expect, it takes a lot of money to get a device to market. So a company like ours that's developing a device goes from what we sometimes refer to as a science experiment to a company, right? And there's a lot involved there. You go from making prototypes and batches of one or two or three to now having to go into actually manufacturing more with more controls involved. This requires a lot more resources. It requires a lot more people. That's one aspect of it. The other is it costs a fair amount of money to run a clinical trial. There's a lot involved there. So the capital that we've just raised here is used for primarily three things. One is we need more people. So we are in the process of doubling the size of the company, both at leadership levels, as well as mid-level managers, as well as frontline workers, as I mentioned, similar to manufacturing, quality systems, clinical operations, regulatory, manufacturing, you know, all the operational people. There's a lot involved. We're building a real company with processes and systems and people that have expertise in startups, big companies, engineers that have experience in medical device, and engineers that have experience in the aerospace industry, which is a very close parallel to us. It's both industries are highly regulated. And that sort of experience is something that we really are looking for people who understand that sort of environment. We're spending the money on running the trial, and we're spending money on actually manufacturing pumps and ramping that ability to do that. So that's where the vast majority of the money is going to right now.
What was the raise process like? Because I know 2023 has been an interesting year for VC so far. And then I think there's also the added challenge of medical device, you know, having that longer pathway to ROI. So what was the process of raising like? What's your relationship with the investors like?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'd start out on a generic level and say that in medical devices, particularly ones that have a regulatory path that is fairly lengthy like ours, because we have what's known as a class three device, which is the most risk device that takes the longest to get to market and is the most burdensome from a regulatory standpoint. There's a large majority of investors that if they're going to invest in medical devices, they're not even interested in class three devices because they're interested in a shorter term return on their investment. We've been very fortunate that our investors are not only in it for a return on investment, but really are in it for the long haul. they see the advantage of the total artificial heart in terms of solving this heart failure problem that we have, and, you know, are able to continue to invest in it because they believe in it, and they're patient investors. We ordinarily, you know, they're, I think, a different breed of investors that you would typically see for a medical device that has a lower risk, or, you know, class one or class two, where, you know, we want you to get approval within 2 years, 3 years, and then we want you to commercialize, and then we want you to sell the company and everyone wins, right? That's not necessarily, we have a very different timeline and a far more sophisticated investors in that regard. And so, yes, it was a very different and difficult macro environment in order to raise money. But really, it came down to the fact that our investors see the big picture and see the long-term value of staying involved. And so we were able to continue to get their support and even raise more money than we had originally thought to raise, because many of these projects ultimately can take longer and run a little bit more money than you originally can forecast. And you need that extra buffer, if you will, because things don't always work out perfectly the first time you do it. And so I think we're in a very, very good spot right now. A lot of investors are not interested in medical devices until they go to the clinic, until they have human data. And so, again, it also requires a savvy investor to be able to see the data and the progress before you get to humans and value that, and from their standpoint, get in earlier before the results start coming out, knowing that typical for a medical device, when things go well in humans, the valuation of the company goes up quite a bit at that point, because that's really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in terms of medical device feasibility.
That is very interesting to hear. I don't know that I knew that about medical device and the different pathways to VC funding there are for you. So I know you already mentioned a little bit about what the Texas Heart Institute, what role that institution played for BiVACOR, but also let's talk about like the now and the future of the company's presence in Houston. I know it's a truly global company, right? You're operating in everywhere from the West Coast to Australia. So how do you navigate that, and what's the Houston presence now versus in the future?
Well, you know, a lot of our testing, particularly animal testing, is done in Houston. We're going to be training all our clinical sites there in Houston. And we're going to continue to do ongoing testing there, because you never stop learning. We're well past what we say is design phase, to where we're very comfortable with the design of the device. And we've been verifying and validating, you know, many aspects of it. And we'll be ready to then put this in humans. But there's always more. And we have a long-term plan of iterating on the device and making it, you know, better than it was before. Well, we have to learn from that, right? There's an external electrical box that is the controller that we can make smaller. And there's a cable or a line that goes out of the patient's body through the skin to a box. We'll be able to get rid of that altogether by doing what's known as wireless energy transfer, similar to what when you put your iPhone on a little charger. It's the same concept, far more complicated, of course, and quite a bit more power requirements. But we want to get to that too, because you want to be able to, you know, be able to get rid of that line. So a lot of the testing is in Texas, in Houston. We do a lot of our manufacturing here, as well as in Texas, other areas of Texas. We have one of our key suppliers is in Dallas. We are out here in California because I think historically we came out here because it was one of the few pump manufacturers that could actually create the device the way we wanted it. And we have three of our really key suppliers right here within half an hour of us. And that really saves a lot of time because, particularly when you're in the iterative process, it's great to be able to move things around and just quickly go from one place to another and be on site if you have to. So that's kind of the genesis of where we were from a California standpoint is that, we have key suppliers here, and it's a fairly complex system with many, many suppliers. And so supplier management and the relationship with them are critical. And so being here in California next to those, we frequently have people going back and forth to Texas, both in Dallas and Houston. Many of our software engineers are based in Australia. That's a typical situation where a lot of that can be done remotely, although a fair number of them come here to California and spend 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time working closely with our other engineers. And then we have several key people that work remotely in Europe, mostly in Germany, and they come here periodically as well. There's only a few hubs, if you will, around the world that have experience in pumps. And, Germany has a lot of rich experience there that we're taking advantage of. Australia, many of the previous heart pump technology companies have come out of there. And the Australian government has been very generous in terms of grants. And we've really taken advantage of that in terms of being able to get money from the Australian government to help our cause.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you've really taken opportunities across the world rather than, a more traditional company being based in one place and growing, and then maybe expanding. You're really getting the best of every part of the world, to develop the best technology and have the best go-to-market strategy, I guess. So without all that being said, what is on the horizon? I know you spoke a little bit about this FDA regulatory process, but really, what do you see for both like short term and long term on the horizon for Vivacore?
Well, the short term is, we'll be doing our first in human likely before the end of this year, at Texas Heart. That's the plan for now. And then next year will be spent implanting more patients and learning because there's a lot to learn. We don't know everything about how the device will perform in a human. And there's a lot to it, and the doctors need to learn how to manage patients with this device because it is newer technology. It is designed differently. We think it's going to be a whole lot better than anything that they've ever seen, but there's a learning curve with all of this. So we'll spend the most of all of next year learning and implanting. From there, we will go on to what I mentioned earlier, which is a pivotal trial. And that will take a few years, 2 to 3 years, to get us to where we have enough patients that FDA will be satisfied to give us a market approval to be used there. As I mentioned before, we want to improve the system. So we have all kinds of different iterations that we're planning on. This is just the first iteration that will go in humans, but there will be newer iterations with additional features. And again, the long-term goal is if you're going to implant this and be the final solution for someone with end-stage heart failure, it would be great not to have to rely on a driveline that comes out of your skin and connected to a box, that this could be a wirelessly charged with electronics actually on the pump that become less dependent on the external. And so that's more of a long-term. And then, of course, like many companies, we would, from a commercial standpoint, branch out from the US and look at the other markets that typically blood pumps have succeeded in and start there. As I already mentioned, Germany is a leader in that regard. We would be in Australia and also other parts of Asia, particularly Japan, South Korea. We might set up manufacturing as well in Australia. It's always important to have dual sources for all your supplies. And Australia could become a really important beachhead for us in terms of serving the Asian market. One thing that I didn't mention is our device is quite a bit smaller than anything that's available out there. And when you think about the Asian body habit as in Japan and South Korea, this becomes problematic with the devices that are currently available. And so being able to serve a small female end-stage heart failure patients in Japan and South Korea, these are developed nations that are rapidly aging like the US. And so their incidence of heart failure continues to increase and is a major problem. So this is an opportunity for us as well. So that's kind of the short and long-term plan for the company at this point.
Yeah, I think looking at both the short term and the long term, which is very exciting to think that far in advance about the impact this technology can have on people and their families and loved ones. I kind of have a question for you from your perspective. What keeps you up at night thinking about this future? What concerns are you do you have about the world or other potential impacts on getting to that finish line of being able to help these patients with heart disease.
Yeah, well, if anyone has ever been in my position, they know that there's a thousand things that you worry about. But I surprisingly, you might find this surprising to hear, but what I'm not so worried about is how the device will perform, because I can see all the details, and I've been around this therapy and seen many devices before, so that doesn't worry me so much. It's usually that the fact, like with many companies, things can take longer than you anticipate, and they require more money, and that's an ongoing battle that you see with all medical devices. Can you get to where you need to go with the money you have? So it's pretty obvious. We have $18 million. Are we going to be able to get to a point to where the money is about to run out or is running out, but we have lots of good reasons for other investors now to jump in, or our current investors, and say, yes, we want to keep putting in more money, right? And so that means you have to take your company to another inflection point. And for us, it's having clinical data. So what keeps me up at night is making sure that the ship is going in the right direction and at the right speed, because we don't want to go too fast, because speed will literally kill in our profession. We can't afford mistakes. We can't afford defects. And that, comes from just not what we do, but from our suppliers. We're not building race cars to where you lose the race. We're building pumps that sustain life. And if there's a defective component or there's a problem, then it has dire ramifications to the patient. So quality is number one in medical devices, and it certainly is for us. We have to ensure that that's what we're getting. And so we create a culture where people can raise their hand and say, I think this might be a problem. We need to stop here and fix this, as opposed to, oh, we just need to hit our timelines and we need to go fast. That's a balance. It's a balance with using your cash efficiently, getting to where you need to go, and get to that inflection point before the money runs out, versus cutting corners and doing it too fast and then missing things, or just looking at something and say, well, that's probably not going to be a problem. Well, do you really know that, right? And so this, and the thing that's just so amazing about this company is we've done it with probably a third or a quarter of the number of employees that companies have done this before. And so we're now adding the people that we need so we can move along a little bit faster and get that clinical data. And once we get that clinical data, I think it's going to be hard to keep the door from being knocked down from all the people that will be interested. And that will be a wonderful problem to have, to be able to just continue the cycle of creating value, providing something more meaningful, in our case, clinical data, and then getting the shot in the arm that we need in terms of cash to keep moving and developing and iterating and getting further down the regulatory path.
Yeah, that's such an important reminder of the challenges that medical device and specifically BiVACOR is facing. So I appreciate your perspective on that. And it is a good sign to know that you're not worried about the technology. You know firsthand the needs of the industry and the patients. So it's very exciting to hear, and I can't wait to keep covering VivaCore's journey. So thank you so much for your time today and your perspective.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I love talking about this. I mean, it is very exciting, and it's just, you know, for people who are interested in this field or interested in startups, just seeing what the end result is going to be just makes you work so much harder and enjoy it at the same time. And so it's just been a lot of fun for everyone here. Yes, we're all working ridiculous hours, but we see the light at the end of the tunnel, and we see the benefit that we're going to have to the community and to medicine in general. And that's just keeps everybody going.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.